And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Son of Slovenia, cool as hell. He scores the ball and he rebounds well. Don't fight the future. Here comes Luka. Even losses feel like wins when you're with your good friend Tim.
Hello, this is 77 Minutes, a Dallas Mavericks podcast, part of the Athletic Podcast Network, the only Mavericks podcast that revolves around the sun. I'm Tim Cato, I write and talk about the Mavericks, and we're going to talk about heliocentrism today. Luka Doncic, his usage, how much he just touches and dominates the ball has been the conversation over the past week or so, and boy, it was highlighted without him in the Mavericks' loss to the Houston Rockets on Wednesday. I've got Mike Pellucci, you know him, co-host, D Magazine, sports editor.
Sorry, a lot of S's involved there, yeah.
I know, it's like a tongue twister. And we've got Seth Partnow, who, athletic contributor, contributed to a lot of other places, used to be analytics director for the Milwaukee Bucks. How are you, Seth?
I'm doing well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely, appreciate it. Let's just start with the obvious, which is, when you wrote the word heliocentrism into some article like 3 years ago, did you ever imagine that it would turn into basically this basketball lingo that is used to describe this phenomenon of an offense revolving around one player?
Not at all. I was trying to be cutesy with the headline and use a big word. And that's the one I picked. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I was on a Copernicus kick or whatever, but there was no thought that went into it as a thing, and now it's a thing. And I think it's a reasonable thing. It's just funny that you know, anyone who's ever like gone viral in any way for anything, it's like, oh, that was not intentional. It just kind of happened that way.
It's a good term to describe kind of this phenomenon, like I said.
I mean, for the Mavs more than any team at this point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to them. But I first want to ask you, just where did heliocentrism come from in the broad scheme of the NBA and how schematically the league has shifted to revolve around, you know, single ball handlers and offenses? A lot of it, of course, comes from the three-point era and the rise of spacing and the changing pick-and-roll defenses. But I feel like you can explain this even better than I can.
I mean, I think it's you know, if listeners have any sort of like gaming background, the concept of min-maxing is essentially what's going on here. The hardest skill to find at a high level in the NBA is on-ball creation. I mean, And to be clear, it's high level on ball creation, because the difference in value between mediocre on ball creation and good on ball creation is tremendous. So players who are kind of above the line of this is useful, this is helpful, are hard to find. So what if we just loaded all that burden on one guy who can do that, and then use our resources, use our draft picks, use our salary dollars, use our minutes and roster spots on guys who can do all the other stuff, and let the one guy take care of that one thing? And, you know, off ball shooting and wing defense and rim running and things like that are, you know, they're not easy to find, but relatively, and in terms of, you know, what they cost in terms of whatever, whether it's dollars or draft capital or what have you, they're cheaper. So you can get more bang for your buck by loading up on this one guy and filling up all the other skills with kind of, you know, specialists and role players around them. And I think we've seen in a number of different examples that can be very effective in the regular season. The problem is it's brittle. both in terms of, okay, you're very dependent on the one central star, but also if you are called upon to play a different way, you don't really have much in the way of other options.
That sounds like a very apt Dallas Mavericks description right there, Seth Parnell.
I mean, they aren't the first team to have this problem. I mean, it's you know, the Harden Doncic comparisons have really been made since his rookie year, and it's a similar problem to what some of those Rockets teams had. And frankly, those Rockets teams had, I would say, more talents to kind of overcome than this Mavericks roster does.
Yeah, we've seen enormous usage rates before, even before the three-point era as we know it now. Kobe Bryant, of course, you know, was somebody who would spike into the 35s and the 36s when it comes to usage rate. Doncic right now is right around 40, and the only other two comparisons, you know, the only two players to have a usage rate over 40, which means when they're on the court, 40% of the possessions are ending in them, whether it's a drawn foul or a shot attempt or a turnover. The only two other players is James Harden and Russell Westbrook, his MVP season. And, you know, obviously, I do think a lot of this also comes from the three-point era, just the fact that there is so much spacing that it's harder to play traditional pick-and-roll coverages, that a lot of teams have recognized that the best pick-and-roll defense is to switch and to switch everything. And that kind of forces teams into this isolation heavy style that does revolve around one player. And there's pros and cons to that, as you hinted. You know, as it relates to Dallas and Doncic, you know, I guess the first question I have is how much is it caused by the player who is capable of it, and how much of it is caused by the roster around it? And I think the answer is kind of both.
Yeah.
Yes. But in Dallas, we've clearly seen that, you know, it's both. Luka does want to play this way to an extent, but the Mavericks don't have a roster that would realistically right now facilitate a dramatically different style of play.
I hate to have to use it as the comparison just because the linkages are always going to be there. But I mean, I think you see it a little bit in Atlanta, where there has been some willingness on the part of Trae Young to alter to some extent how he's played. I think we saw it to even greater effect in kind of before everything went completely to shit in Brooklyn when Harden first got there, and he basically played like game manager point guard for the first three quarters of games a lot of the time when he was playing alongside Durant and Kyrie, and then in fourth quarter it's like, well, I've got a bunch of energy, so I'm gonna wreck stuff now. There is precedent of players kind of ceding some of that given the roster around them. I don't know if how much like this is a demand of how Luka must play. Like certainly one of his big, you know, burst on the stage moments was EuroBasket 2018. Is that, do I have that? 2017. Yeah. When, you know, he was the best player at the tournament, but Goran Dragic won the most valuable player of the tournament. And that certainly was multiple ball handlers. Now, both of them have a little bit of a ball dominant style. So it was a little bit your turn, my turn. So I think there's probably some of it. That's the way he prefers to play. And it's also the way this roster is built up. And the question is kind of, can they do anything? And is he at the point where he's ready to, okay, I need to become more of a spot up threat. I need to work off ball. I need to be a decoy some more. And I'm okay with that, even if the person who has the ball isn't as good as me.
Well, yeah, so I think it's two separate questions, right? It's is Luka ready for it? Mm-hmm. But that couldn't even be answered until the roster is set up for it.
Yep.
And I think Mike Pelucci, you had Istok Franco in D Magazine, a piece that, you know, you worked with him on and edited. And I thought it was really telling that, you know, it's not just a Luka thing. It's a Luka Doncic and Spencer Dinwiddie thing that they control the ball. They have the ball in their hands. And I'm quoting Istok right here. More than 70% of the time each game, it's unprecedented for two people to control the offense so much. Even other heliocentric teams such as Atlanta and Memphis have three players within the 70% mark. While most teams spread that load around among four or five players. That's me quoting what Istok wrote in a really good piece on D Magazine. What was your takeaways from that, Mike, and just broadly, you know, what Istok wrote?
Yeah, well, the follow-up to that is, and this is the really good point that Istok made, was we watched this team in the Western Conference Finals last year, and we watched the Golden State Series, and we thought, okay, they have pushed this to its endpoint. They cannot play this way any more than they already have. And then Jalen Brunson leaves, and they basically consolidated three players' touch load into two. And I guess my question, you know, even before we sit here and say, will Luka change, which is, and what would cause Luka to change, it's, you know, and Seth, maybe you can answer this. Are we at the end point here? Like, what is the end point of heliocentricity, either in Dallas or in general? How much more can one or two people do than what is being done right now? I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm just wondering, have they already pushed this past level 11 to some uncharted terrain that nobody's getting to again?
I think they've pushed it past the point where returns diminish. The way that I've liked to put it is, I think you're better off rather than squeezing the extra 10%, the extra whatever, like, pick a number, 10%, you like time on the ball or involvement or however you want to say it. Pick a relatively small number. You're probably better off, instead of squeezing that out, instead having that one player have a lower usage, but having the threat of them be a factor in 30% instead of, essentially, I think the non, like, Luka possessions, he's a passenger. And that was a characteristic of Harden when he was, you know, in Houston, that prior to this year, that was a characteristic of Trae Young. And I think that, you know, you basically, okay, say he 60% of your possessions run through him, and you don't have to care about him on the other 40% of possessions, or 50% have to run through him, but you have to worry about him, you know, 30 or 40 of the, like, most of the remainder of possessions. One of those is obviously better. Like, the 10% you're giving up, you're more than making up in the defense having to account for, you know, okay, well, he can spot up, he can cut, he can duck in to a post up, he can beat us in all these different ways. And I think especially for a player like Luka, who, you know, you talked about the rise of switching defenses, nothing really comes easy for him. Like, he can make the hard stuff, but just from a sheer, like, physical, like, that's a lot of bumps that he takes to get to his stuff. And I think that, regardless of his conditioning, which is, you know, issue, which is what it is, regardless of that, he has to work really hard. So if he's going to do that all game, I don't think it should be a surprise at all that he gasses out in fourth quarters a lot.
Yeah, what you're referring to is what Jason Kidd referred to when he was worried Luka would burn out by Christmas.
Yeah, and so here's the tension that is really fascinating to me, right? I don't think anybody believes this is ideal. But if you look league-wide, this isn't just a Dallas problem. Dallas is kind of a poster child for this. But if you go to the top 20 usage rate seasons of all time, right? None of the players in that top 20 won an NBA title. 14 of those top 20 usage seasons are by currently active players, and 8 of these top 15 are the last 4 years. So, you know, even this year, right? Luka isn't even the usage leader in the NBA as of last night. It's Giannis. Giannis is above him right now. You have Joel Embiid on that list. Different type of player, but still usage rate going through him. You have John Morant on this list. And so you have this tension of, this has not worked yet, and there are red flags for why this may never work, but teams continue to seem to be leaning more into this than ever and trying. So why is that disparity? Is this a matter of teams maybe think they can be the ones to crack the code, and it's the Arrested Development meme of, just because it didn't work for them doesn't mean it can't work for us? Or is there really a way to find a sweet spot here? And if so, what is that?
So I think, I mean, usage rate is a pretty blunt measure of involvement. And
sure,
I think you start to look at, like, you know, you mentioned the time of possession, and also just like the you know, observationally, just the amount of time it's Luka do everything. I think that this has at times been a problem for the Sixers with Embiid. But I think that one of the big differences, I mean, you know, my last year with the Bucks was 2019. That was sort of Giannis's first big year, and a lot of it was Giannis, here's the ball, go. And frankly, against the Raptors in the playoffs, like, they figured that out. And part of the one of the reasons the Bucks were able to break through was, all right, well, Chris Middleton's got to captain the ship, you know, in crunch time, maybe because of his ability to create, you know, against set defense from the mid range. Drew Holiday gives us another option to do some stuff, and that lets Giannis do things like play as a dive man in a pick and roll and stuff like that. So I think that the actual scoring usage may have maintained, but they found some easier ways to get there by these other players. Now, obviously, okay, yes, add two all-star perimeter players to the Mavericks, and what does it look like? And that's obviously not really plausible. So it's not a totally fair comparison. But I think that you have seen, in some ways, just the rebound and against the edge of heliocentrism. I mean, I think a trend that I'm sort of watching is teams are going back to multiple ball handlers and playmakers even more. I think a big part of Utah's success in the early season is they've had four and five playmakers on the floor at once. Cleveland, these are players who by skill set and sort of inclination have more off ball than you know, a Doncic or a Harden in terms of Darius Garland, Donovan Mitchell. That seems like it's worked pretty well with those two balancing, even though they haven't, because of injuries, they haven't gotten a ton of reps together. So I think we are seeing that, you know, if we back off of that, just some of the underlying stuff is sound. Like, we don't want, yeah, the Mavericks don't want to be in an offense where a big creation burden falls on Dorian Finney-Smith. Dorian Finney-Smith is a very good player. That's not his jam. But maybe, okay, we've pushed it a little too far and it's time to pull back to a little bit more of a happy medium where we're getting the most, not just out of Luka, but out of the team by using the threat of Luka to open space for other people. And not just the threat of him with the ball, his presence, where he doesn't actually have to expend much. He can just kind of stand productively and other players can like use his gravity to their benefit.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
You've said, we've said, I think it's understood that where heliocentrism, where this focus on one offensive player really fails for teams, is in the postseason. Why is that? Is it as simple as the increase in minutes and fatigue? I know that has, like, that's obviously a big factor here. Are there other factors that go into the struggles that we've seen from teams that are dominated, whose offenses are dominated by one player in the postseason?
I think it makes you really easy to game plan for, is part of it. I mean, I think over the course of the series, like, okay, we're going to throw six different defenders at him, and, you know, boxing analogies or whatever, but it's like, all right, we're going to, you know, just spend the first three games just throwing body shots and see if he has any legs left by game four, game five, game six. That I think that works both over the course of a game, but also cumulatively over the course of a series, and if fortunate enough, over multiple series. So I think that just sort of, you know, having to beat your head against that wall to win 2, 3, 4 playoff series, I think you said the degree of difficulty is high. Degree of difficulty is always high to progress deep in the playoffs. But I think that you're sort of almost blunting your best weapon by.
And we've
by
almost
letting,
seen that. We've yeah. almost seen that in the regular season thus far, where, you know, I had a joking conversation with a Mavericks executive about how all teams in the league should get on a conference call and collaborate and say, hey, we're going to make Luka, you know, expend as much energy in every single game. And it was a joke and obviously not enforceable, but teams have done this to an extent. They're slowly changing how exactly they play, but there has been a big emphasis on making Luka work, making Luka get his points. And not helping to the point that the Mavericks are going to get into this humming ball movement, pass around the perimeter offense. And there's also been a point to some extent, or maybe this is just natural from the defenders, that they're banking a lot of contact with Luka. They're fouling him. At one point, Jason Kidd talked about how after a game, Luka had been fouled a lot leading up to that game, and he praised Luka for landing on his feet more. And it, like, that directly makes me think of, you know, just how much work it is to absorb as many fouls and go to the line and drive as many times as he does as a player. And so, you know, when this conversation about Luka just, you know, 11 and 12 games into the season is about, will he burn out by, you know, the end of the calendar year, which is not how you should be talking about your star player, you know, one fifth of the way into the season, even less than that. I think that's a large part of it, that we're already seeing teams take lessons from what works in the postseason and apply it to this player that isn't really able to be stopped by any single scheme or even multiple schemes on a single night basis. But you apply that over a longer stretch, even a regular season stretch, and it is taking something out of him that's affecting him, and that's causing the Mavericks to really second guess and reconsider this approach.
I mean, they might second guess and reconsider, but then what?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. Like, what where do they go from here? And that's a really hard one to answer.
No, and this is I mean, this is This is a weird situation that they find them. It's an unfortunate situation they find themselves in. It is hard to see a way out that does not involve moving a direction other than forwards first.
Yeah,
and that's hard, because you can't, barring an injury, you can't just tank with Luka. So that's not the way it's going to work. But you have to do something to, you know, the Mavs have for. Basically, since the championship year, have kind of always ended up with rough, but fairly full cap sheets. And, you know, you okay, Dwight Powell making, you know, double digits per year. Dwight Powell's fine, but you start to stack those 10, 12, 14, $18 million contracts together, and all of a sudden, oh man, we're not just in the we're not just over the cap. We're butting up against the tax, and we haven't even made a move yet. So, just getting to the point of kind of clearing all of that up, and then frankly being more judicious in the future about not giving out these, you know, 4-year deals with for $12.5 million for a guy who's a, you know, a fourth to ninth guy in your rotation.
Well,
that leads us to an obvious question.
This does a difference of scale, because Jalen Brunson was obviously not your ninth player in the rotation, but the figure that Dallas would have had to pay, presuming he even wanted to come back, right? You know, let's imagine a world in which Jalen calls Dallas and says, look, cut the check, I'll be there. On the one hand, we sit here and say this team needs more ball handlers. The league's going to more ball handlers. That was a ball handler who knew how to play with Luka Doncic. On the other hand, that would not have been the most efficient pricing. Looking back at it now, did Dallas make the right call to let him go, or are they having some second thoughts? And if you're them, should they have second thoughts seeing what they look like now?
I think the thing that I'll say is that the collective offseason didn't make any sense. I think for those reasons, letting him go rather than you know, getting up to like $30 million a year was right. But then why are you handing out multi-year contracts to JaVale McGee and you know, bringing in Christian Wood at big money? Like, it's like, okay, we've done the first step of not digging the hole deeper, so let's start to get ourselves out of the hole of kind of our messy books. I mean, it's not that, I mean, that was less about Jalen Brunson and more about having, you know, Tim Hardaway Jr. and Davis Bertans and Dwight Powell and all these other players on the books for cloggy amounts and multiple years out. So you have to stop that somewhere. And I think it's defensible to say, okay, Brunson's where we can't, we got to stop now. But then following that up with moves that sort of almost further compound the underlying issue.
They re-signed Maxi Kleber as well. You know, another player who's looking like he's, you know, starting to feel his age.
Yeah. I really like Maxi Kleber, but
I do
again,
too.
But it's again, if you're like, you know, your second and third, or even third and fourth best players are Dorian Finney-Smith and Maxi Kleber. Like, how good does the one guy have to be? And, you know, basically it's like the only guy who's been able to really have success in that sort of construct is prime LeBron. And as good as Luka is, I'm not hating to say that he's not and probably will never be as good as prime LeBron.
I think that's fair, because that is the highest bar to clear. Let me just end this podcast by asking, you know, I think we've kind of covered the rise and perhaps fall of heliocentrism. Like, I think teams are starting to, in some ways, move away from it, or we're seeing teams at least understand the limitations of it. Do you enjoy it? Do you think that this has been a good era or a fun era of basketball to watch and consume?
There are different ways you can do it. Like you mentioned, like, I find Memphis very watchable. There are times where I think the Mavs are very watchable, and there's times where it's a little sloggy. Similarly with Atlanta, the late stage Harden was not super, like the very static version of it was not very. And I think that's part of what makes kind of the Grizzlies and the Hawks maybe a little more fun, is there's movement at least. Whether it's guys coming off of pick and roll or there being some kind of action on the weak side. So it's not just, you know, everyone look at me, I'm going to go between my legs three times and step back and shoot a jumper, which is more the Harden way. And Luka's isn't that, but it's more, I'm going to dribble a little bit. I'm going to pivot. I'm going to run into you. I'm going to step back. And it's like, that's neat.
What he's doing is mechanical. What he's doing is mechanical, but how he's doing it is not nearly anywhere close to as mechanical as James Harden could be.
Yeah, but it is clunky.
Yeah,
just from an aesthetic standpoint.
Mike, any closing thoughts?
No, I mean, I think the question is, I think we know where they are. I think we know how they've gotten here. I think we know what corner they backed themselves into. The story of this team and the story of whatever Luka Doncic's tenure in the intermediate future is going to be is how they get themselves out of it, or if they can get themselves out of it.
I think that's where the Mavericks are, and I think, you know, enduring the season, finding ways to make it a little bit better so that Luka isn't burning out like Christmas. Again, a quote that came from the head coach of the team. This isn't, you know, some speculation.
If I can break in, I think we're going a little overboard with stuff. Like
I would agree. I would agree. I mean, That's why I specify it's from the team, because I wouldn't say that, quite frankly. Yeah. I think it is a bit much. I think it's quite excessive.
I mean, I think it's like, not to make a, you know, it's a different thing, but I think, everyone thought the Suns were going to be turmoil this year because of the way. And so we're a little bit carrying a playoff narrative over into the regular season where it doesn't necessarily apply. There's still things you worry about, like, you know, fourth quarter offense, giving up leads and stuff like that. But they're still going to be good enough that they'll be fine.
So the Sun that we're actually revolving around is Phoenix, not Luka Doncic. Here it is all along.
Probably should stop recording now. It's only downhill from here, guys.
Yeah, I think we'll end it there on that terrible joke. But thank you, Seth, for sharing some knowledge with us. Thank you, Mike. And listeners, thank you. We'll see you next week. See ya.
He plays Fortnite just like me. I am 34. Don't fight the future, honey. Don't fight the future. The future is Luka, Big Dick Doncic, from the home of Melania Trump. How many kids you have? Don't fight the future. It tears me apart. Don't fight the future. Please be nice to Luka. Future four-time MVP.
Oh, my God. Shut it down!
Oh,
let's go home! It's a wrap, Doug!
That is a wrap.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.